G'day guys, welcome back to the Best Of episodes. This is Best Of Entertainment. Honestly, entertainment, we had no idea what to call this episode. We've got guests from everywhere, books, podcasters, sexologists, yeah, just about everything, radio stars, XFL players, musicians. So it's been cool. This has probably been like the favorite sort of thing for me this year, is like branching out into doing new guests. So I love, you know, getting so many people on from different sort of backgrounds. Like, I know it's not diverse as such, but definitely diverse from what we've been doing, but always keen to grow that out a lot more and as much as we can. So we released another Best Of episodes last week, Best Of Sport. Make sure you check that one out. Had some cool athletes on, but yeah, this one today includes Mark Howard, Jack Post, Mark Wales, Chantal Otten, our first musical guest, Talanova, and Brandon Jack. But yeah, it's been huge. So basically, I'll take you through them. Number 97, Mark Howard, who obviously is in the OG of podcasting for Howie Games, been a big, you know, inspiration for me, and yeah, just been a good mentor going through and just, you know, hearing his story about how he started, which is not very similar to mine, but I suppose in a way, like, you know, starting from the bottom and working your way up and just trying to upskill yourself in as much as possible. And he even spoke about, you know, it's been a really good thing for him, and something he looks to now and has helped him a lot was not getting a start early, because he had to really earn it and make sure he really nailed it, you know, the whole time in his career. And he's not just good at what he does now, but if he had to go pick up a camera, he'd still probably be able to do it, which I'd be interested to know if he would really do that. 106, Jack Post. Absolutely love Jack Post. He's one of the funniest dudes of all time. I still can't, you know, laugh so much about when he came to the studio. I was just like, he did like this TikTok and was just filming everything. But yeah, he's a ripper dude, and absolutely loved his time on the show. He spoke about working with Hamish and Andy, and yeah, similar to Howie's story as well, I spoke about like getting a start in the media and how hard it is to get into radio, but his start there, and you know, he's made a career of it now, working with, you know, Christian O'Connell as well on his breakfast show, and Hamish and Andy, and doing some awesome stuff. Number 95, Mark Wales. This was one of my favorite podcasts of the year, and I think this was Sam's favorite podcast of the year. He's an ex SAS soldier in Australia, and it's unbelievable, you know, what our Defence Force put themselves through and do for us, and you know, unbeknownst to the extent of what they really do for us is incredible. And shout out to anyone out there that works in our Defence Force listening, you know, massive respect for everything you do. And I think everyone would, after hearing this episode of what, you know, Mark's been through with his time. He spoke about some of his most intense tours that he's been through. He spoke about, you know, suffering from PTSD post a lot of his tours, and then spoke about, you know, how dangerous not just, you know, combat is, but even the training to get into it. So definitely check this one out. Next up, which was a very different podcast, but one that I really love this year and get so many messages about to this day, how much it's really benefited and how much people like this podcast, with Chantal Otten, number 94. She's a psychosexologist and basically works a lot around love and sex and intimacy and love languages as well. And yeah, it was just really cool to get her in, and she spoke about love languages, which is something that I've been really interested in, you know, how people accept love and how they give love and how to have the best relationships going forward. And she also spoke a lot about like most common problems that people come to see her for, especially us males, that we might not, you know, want to talk about a lot. So yeah, definitely check that one out. I really love this chat with Chantal. She's doing incredible things. Episode 104 with Talanova, our musical guest, as I said a few times, the first one we had on the show. I'd love to keep getting as much musical guests on Dylan Friends as we can. They spoke about their journey into music, how to start a band, you know, how to even make money. Just so many questions I had about it. It was really cool. But this little snippet speaks about Joshua Mariotti, who is an absolute legend. Spoke about a story of him in LA meeting Robert Pattinson, who is the guy from Twilight. And yeah, very funny story there. So make sure you check that one out. And last up, we had Brandon Jack, episode 105, who's in entertainment now, because, you know, he's an ex-athlete, but also wrote a book. And that's, you know, very impressive, and loved getting him on to speak about his new book. But something we really bonded over, which was, you know, really embarrassing, I suppose, but also vulnerable and hopefully just gives insight into where your mindset at is when you're playing elite sport. It was talking about being on the fringe and the thoughts that go through your head about your teammates and even your friends, you know, like hoping other people are getting injured and, you know, just because you want to do so well yourself. But it was weird to, you know, say some of those things out loud, because we just never spoken to them and admitted them before. But yeah, to hear that and then hear so many other players reach out and say that they'd experienced the exact same thing was really eye-opening. So yeah, check these podcasts out. Hope you enjoy them. Hope you have an incredible break. Hope you're on a road trip somewhere with your head out the window with the sun on your face and having fun. So yeah, thanks so much. Love it. Thanks so much to all the guests for coming on this year. Enjoy these episodes. Check it out. You. Episode 106, Jack Post.
You're never going to walk into a radio station or like a TV set or whatever it is and just be the person who's on air. Like, you got to go through that thing of doing all the jobs. And I did all of them. Like, my first thing was cutting up podcasts for Hamish and Andy and uploading them. I would do audio production. I would answer phones. I would stay in panel shows, you know, pushing the buttons for shows that were coming from Sydney overnight. Like, I just tried to do everything in the arena, always try and do my best job that I can at it, always try and be available and not expect anything in return. I did a lot of working for free. I'm not saying that this is the right way to do it and this is the right thing for businesses to exploit people and make them work for free, but it works because if you're that person who's always putting yourself out there, eventually an opportunity is going to make way and you can grab it with both hands. So this, you have to go back a fair way. Yeah. I was on season one of Gap Year, and yeah, then they canned me and said, okay, you can just work behind the scenes now. You're not good enough to be on television. And in that episode, Hamish had bought this three-wheeled like motorbike / police car that can go up on sidewalks. And so they tasked me of like, you got to look after this vehicle for us. As a joke, you're like, you'll be the security guard of it. And then what I didn't realize was a further joke was they hired two guys to come and steal it off me when it felt like the TV show had already ended for the night. They were just actors, but you know, one guy was pretending to hold a knife under his jumper and he told me do the right thing. I'll never forget that. He's like, do the right thing, like you'll get stabbed if you don't give this to me. But I didn't let him steal the car, so I got in the green room and everyone was like, I kind of was like a little bit of a hero for the night.
Episode 97, Mark Howard. Big key messages and I suppose lessons you've learnt from guests. We spoke about it earlier, we speak about it again because I feel like it's the reason you do podcasting, you know, in a selfish way. And it's not selfish because everyone else gets to listen to it, but it's selfish because you're there experiencing it and you get to ask the questions. Has there ever been something that really stands out to you in an interview or a chat with someone where you've just been like, fuck, I needed to hear that. That was huge for me.
I always finish mine. We're lucky, as you do, to have a lot of kids listen with their parents. So my last question of the podcast is always, for all the youngsters out there, what advice would you give? I should compile that into a motivational book because I've had answers that have blown me away. The general, I'll give you two answers to that. The overall theme that I take from my podcast, which is when we're saying if you had your time again and the things you would have learned, is for every Ricky Ponting that was always going to play for Australia because he was so talented, there are 99 John Aloisis who had to work every step of the way to get where they are. So my main takeaway from the podcast as a general rule, but a really strong rule, is those that work the hardest achieve the most success. That is, it's such a cliche deal, but it's a cliche because it is true. Like John Aloisi, his brother was a better footballer than he was growing up, but he said, I worked harder than my brother. You know, he scored the goal that put us in the World Cup. The piece of advice, and it may be because it's in my mind, because it's actually the episode as we sit here today, it comes out today. So I recorded last week with Daniel Kowalski. And his view on the world was, it doesn't matter what you do in the world, what level of success you do or don't have. The way he judges success is on how nice a person you are to those that you come across. And I haven't said it as elegantly as he said it, but his basic message was, be a good person and everything else will take care of itself, whether it's in the sporting field, the business field, any other field. And that really hit me because I work in a really competitive industry and it's like your industry, it's dog eat dog. And it just hit me just be a nice person and things will go your way. And even if things don't go your way, people always say, you know what, that Howie, he's a pretty good bloke.
Episode 94, Chantel Otten. What would you say to someone then that is listening today that probably hasn't, you know, has just thought that this is the norm for them, this is the way it's going to be, issues that are arising that they might not know is an actual issue that can be fixed? What would you say to them?
I would definitely say come in and see a sexologist. And if you don't get an answer from your sexologist, find a different one. It's like seeing a doctor, you know, not everyone's going to fit. Not everyone's going to give you what you need. And not everyone specializes in your area. I know that, like, there are some things that I'm not great at, you know, practicing with. So I refer to one of my colleagues instead. And I do think it is about just knowing that it's completely normal to have these bumps in the road, and all we need to do is just, like, move over the top of them with some help. You need a big push, and you need someone who's going to get in the passenger seat and do it with you. So I always say to my patients when they come in, it's you and me against the problem now, or it's you, me, and your partner against the problem. It's not us against each other. It's not you and your partner against each other. This is not something we asked for. It's literally like a dark cloud that is hanging over the top of you, and we want it to go away.
And even now, like, when you say this, and you're so comfortable with this, but I suppose being, you know, growing up as a male and not being as comfortable with my sexuality as you are now, because you've obviously studied this and it's you talk to people about it every day. You practice most days. Why do you think it's so hard for us to talk about? Is it just the way we've grown up, you know, not really being able to talk about this openly? You know, I have throwbacks to sex ed, and it was one of those classes where I was like, fuck, I need to get into this and learn some stuff, but would never ask a question.
Yeah.
You know, you sit there and you're like, please just teach me, but I don't want to ask anything.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, it was really, like, if you look back at media from back in the day, what were we watching? Like, was it American Pie? Was that the movie? You know how they were, like, everything was, like, so taboo and it was, like, so wild, and there was a guy and he fucked a pie and it was, like, you know, crazy. Like, that is the media that we grew up with. We looked at sex as more of a joke. We looked at women's safety and consent as a joke. We looked at, you know, men and how they were meant to conquer sex and be passionate and be rough, and, you know, it was very much about the penis owner. And that is, like, the foundation that we grew up with. We also have inadequate sex education in Australia. So you're really left, like, questioning, you know, I know, like, how to make a baby, and I know maybe to put on a condom, but I don't know how to ask for it, and I don't know how to do it, and I don't know what happens if it goes wrong as well, or who I turn to. And then maybe if you turn to a doctor, you go in and you ask them, you know, why do I have erectile dysfunction, or why have I got premature ejaculation? And they've had a 1-hour lecture on sexual medicine in their medical degrees, so they're not quite sure on what to do either. So you're kind of thrown, if you have a problem with sexuality, into this real whirlwind of inadequate sex education along, like, multiple modalities, if that makes sense. No one's an expert. And I also think when sex is good, it takes up like 10% of your mental capacity. When sex is not going good, it, like, takes up 80% or 90%. You're thinking about it all the time, and there's a lot of shame and, like, pushing it down, and you can't talk to your friends about it because they wouldn't understand, and your partner takes it personally, and it can be a really vicious cycle.
Love languages. It's something that I'm super interested in. I've done the most basic of research on how this works, because I suppose I talk to my partner Justine about this a lot. We are, you know, she's the love of my life, the most beautiful woman in the world. We are so, you know, I'm so happy we're beautiful, but I annoy the fuck out of her. Like, I am the most over affectionate. Like, I just, every time I see her, I just want to be, like, hugging her, tell her how much I love her. And she's had to put in boundaries. We've got rules now. Like, aww. I'm only allowed to hug her 3 times a day. Like, because, like, it just gets too much. And I know that I just want to hug her and just be with her because I'm an affectionate person. But it's actually, the more I do that, it's actually pushing her away more.
Yeah.
And for her, like, she's, you know, the way she shows love is she, you know, she does things. She's just a real doer. Like, she'll plan us to go out for nice lunches and, you know, buy beautiful things for the house, and that's how she expresses her love. So I'm always, like, in this battle of being like, two people in a relationship, it's probably often that they've got different ways of showing their love. How important is this to understand what your love language is and how you receive love and what your partner's is as well?
So should I explain a little bit more about what love language is?
I think we should. I've probably just jumped right into it, yeah.
All right. So love languages is a questionnaire. It's a quiz that was made up by a psychologist. It's really actually spot on. Basically, it explains that the way that we show love to others is the way that we want to receive love. So you are saying to me, I want some hugs. I want some cuddles. I want some kisses. I want some skin on skin. That is how you want Justine to show you love.
Yep.
So you're putting that onto her. But, yep. you know, she's saying, she loves doing acts of service. So maybe she wants you to do more acts of service. Yes. Basically, we have to look at what our partner wants from us in order to feel loved. And we have to find a balance there. So it comes up with our top priorities. And if we look at the results of the quiz, the love languages are acts of service, physical affection, receiving gifts, words of affirmation, and physical touch. And I'm a big believer in doing love languages because I think that it actually sorts out a lot of relationship problems as well. But the key is to actually come to an agreement together. If you need more than three hugs in a day, to feel love, then that is something that you need to negotiate with your partner, especially if you're having a rough week. Like, you might go, babe, I know I've hit my max today, but I just need like 10. I need 10 hugs today, or I need to just lie down next to you for a little bit, or we need to snuggle on the couch. And I'm going to do some more acts of service for you as well to make sure that you're feeling loved and cared for. And I think that once you can find out what your partner's love language is, it is about the communication around that. You have your top love languages, but I also believe in incorporating all the love languages, just obviously putting a preference on the top results for your partner.
With that as well, when there's times where you always want what you can't have. So then there's times where I'm on the couch, I just want to be by myself. And then she'll try and, you know, your partner tries to cuddle you and you're like, please remove yourself from me. I just want my own time right now. But I found the best thing for me in my relationship, and she's the most private person in the world, so she's going to be absolutely hating this right now, but I know that when, you know, she's had a bad day or been upset, straight away I'll go home, clean the house, make the bed, cook dinner. And that's like the biggest way that I can show love to her. So I think it's just the importance, as you said, is finding what is the strongest one for your partner and knowing that what that can make them happy the most.
Totally. And you know what you described to me before as well is you're sometimes like, I really need a hug, and she'll distance herself. So that's classic pursuer distance behavior.
Episode 105, Brandon Jack.
What are some of those feelings and thoughts you had when getting omitted or not selected or let down in your eyes? What was going through your head?
I mean, there's different stages of it, hey, and some of the darker places you go to are like, you know, you're in a team, but you see yourself as working against that team. And it's like, for example, in my third year, Isaac Heaney came in and played round one, and I thought that spot was mine. Like, I'd had this great preseason. The media was saying I was going to take the next step, but Heaney's played, and Heaney's is a far better player than I was. But in my mind, I'm convincing myself that spot's mine. I'm like, fuck you guys. I'm the best small forward in this team. That's my spot. So then I'm watching the game from the grandstands, and every time Heaney's near the footy, I'm like, don't touch it. I'm like, I hope he doesn't touch it. Or I'm counting his stats. I know how many stats he's had in my head. And I'm kind of like, all right, if he doesn't get any more, then, you know, they might drop him, because I've been dropped for having 12 touches before. Like, it might happen. So, you know, you start, because you want to be in that team so badly, hey, and somebody's in your spot. You know, and then other times I remember I wrote like fuck horse a few times in my diary, because I was like, he's not picking me, even though he's not the one really making the complete decision. But you pick people to be like, I'm going to prove you wrong. Like, I'm going to make you look stupid. I'm going to have 40 touches in the resis. All these sorts of thoughts. And it's pretty fucking toxic when you think about it, but it's just how I would put myself on the edge.
Unbelievable, mate. It's so true. And I don't know how, you know, people listening to this, I really hope that someone can relate to this, but I'm sure they do, because it's not a feeling that is uncommon. I know so many guys that would have felt like this, but I can literally recall the same things in my head just... And it's not you. It's not you as a person. Like,
yeah,
it's like survival. You just want to survive, and that's what it turns into. And even on that whole scenario, like, again, it's not your personal decision. It's just what your mind does. It's fucked.
Well, it's you're in this environment where it's like, we used to do trademarks, personal trademarks all the time. So everyone would have to have their thing, which is like, and even if it wasn't true, you had to say like, I am the best two-way midfielder in the competition. And you had to like say that about yourself, and you had to believe it. But, you know, that's not true for everyone, and it can't be true for everyone. So people who, you know, that self-talk doesn't line up with the reality, you get pushed to this point, you know, and that's where I took it out on some people around me. But the thing, that's the thing, you talk about footy clubs and they're your best mates as well. Like, my best mates were the people I were competing against for a spot. And there's not many workplace environments with that dynamic.
But yeah, exactly right. And it's crazy. Like, you're competing for, you know, one team, one dream. Like, that's the goal, is to win this flag. But, I was chatting to Sam before this, a producer, and he was saying, fuck, like, do you guys actually think like that? Like, that's unbelievable. But in a way, it's nearly healthy, because the drive to get into the team, that's what makes it so strong. So it's like, it's like, you don't want this, but also, like, coaches would be looking, going, fuck, we need this.
Yeah, for sure. And that's something I don't ever want to come across as being like, we shouldn't motivate ourselves like that, because it does. It pushes you towards greatness. I just think that, there's a balance to be found, or a gray area where it doesn't have to be so all-consuming. I still, with my writing, for example, I still do a lot of the same things. And I'm like, if I get a rejection letter about a piece I've published, I'm like, I'm going to show you how good a writer I am. I'm going to write this piece that blows you away. And that works for me. But it's finding that off switch, I reckon, and being able to go, that's when I'm playing footy, that's when I'm writing, and that's got nothing to do with, how I am as a partner or a friend or things like that.
Yeah. No, you're so right. And I experience the same things now with podcasting, for example. You move into a new world and you're in business, and I still have these thoughts about other things, but I go, well, is this actually... do I actually not like this person or this group, or is it more a reflection of me that I'm like vulnerable in this situation?
Yeah, it's checking the podcast charts and seeing where you rank, dude. You do that.
Yeah. Fuck this guy. It's sort of easy when you're at number one all the time, but but I'm thinking, like, when you drop.
Yeah, it won't happen, mate. You'll be fine.
When you were saying about the footy, and again, we don't want to act like you didn't enjoy your footy at all, but was there a stage where it did change for you? Like, were you enjoying it up to a stage and then there was something that happened, or did the all-encompassing stress just come too much?
It was, my first few years in a professional environment were pretty anxious. I was always never a certainty of getting picked and was always in that fringe spot. I think there is a specific moment that I reckon kind of was a big turning point, and it kind of broke me a bit. At the end of my third year, so I reckon I played maybe 9 or 10 games, probably 9 games in a row at the end of 2015. And it felt like, I was finally cementing myself in the team. And I played this shocking final. I think we were in West Australia against Freo, and I played so poorly. And I got dropped for the final the following week against North Melbourne. And from that point on, I kind of really turned my back on footy. Like, I had 2 more years of a contract, but I like clocked out, and I got this phone call from Horse when I was at Bondi Junction, and I knew it was coming. I knew I was going to get dropped. And it was a real quick conversation, and he said, like, we're picking James Rose. He's got more firepower up forward. Do you understand? And I was like, yeah, whatever. And I went off the rails a bit after that. And I think at the same time, that's when I started really jumping into music as well. So I found an escape there. But that's probably after that is when I really started drinking heavily as well and doing all these things that, you use to escape.
Talk us through that, man. Like, what sort of things were you doing? What were you finding comfort in? Was it just being outside of the club? Was it something, was it like a release for you? Because I think one thing that people would definitely understand, not just in footy, but in life, that anyone that's an athlete, and we say that's a lot in the show, but an athlete isn't someone that just plays footy. It's someone that's competitive and has drive. It's hard to turn off the switch when you work so hard and you dedicate your life to something and you have this supreme work ethic and competitiveness that often then translates to off field, and you do that in the same thing you're doing, even if that is negative things.
Say for like music, I really dove into, but the immediate thing that happened after that was I kind of assumed this spot as being like that disgruntled Rezzy's player. Like, there's different kinds of people at each club, and that's one of the kind of, roles you can fall into. And I remember the start of the following preseason, I, along with a couple other guys in a similar position, just organized these drinking events for every Friday night. So we'd train Monday to Friday in preseason and have the weekend off. And we'd organize these big piss up drinking games for Fridays and use that to get us through. And then use that to like completely ride ourselves off. And it was like we played stumps in 4 weeks in a row. We played stumps. We did wizards. Then we did Centurion, which is like 100 shots in 100 minutes, which you know, was not good, and then pub golf. And we like went all out trying to plan these things. And yeah, I mean, there's some funny stories to it, man. Like Wizards, for example, like we had this blazer that we bought from Vinny's. And on the blazer, if you won Wizards each year, you got your name embroidered. If you won if you were best on Footy Trip, you got your name embroidered. So Dean Towers put his name on it 3 times because he voted himself best on Footy Trip. And, you know, like there's some good names on that blazer, man. Like not saying what for, but like Tommy Mitchell's on there, Toby Nankervis, like some good guys are going through the Swans. like some elite names. That's a good list to be a part of. But, you know, like just that was kind of our bonding to comfort each other. But I remember like with Wizards, it was how fast can I build this staff that's as tall as me, like with Cairns, or like pub golf, for example. We had like printed scorecards with all the pubs we were going to. We had all these rules. We all dressed up as golfers and walked around Paddington playing pub golf. And it was meant to be 18 holes. But after 7 holes, I like couldn't walk because I was so A, bent on winning something, and B, kind of just wanted to like drink a lot of this pain I was feeling about footy away. So yeah, there was a lot going on there.
Do you think a part of these as well, and speaking from experience when I was younger, and I think this was pretty prevalent when I was at Carlton, like I probably couldn't get the respect I wanted on the field. So I just wanted to be liked. And that was like a massive part of me just, you know, being an idiot. Like I'd do stupid shit just to somehow maybe impress people. And just, I was just so stupid, like being young, just thinking, I just wanted to be liked instead of being respected and didn't know how to get it.
Yeah, I saw if I couldn't get respect on the footy field from people, because I felt like I didn't have that, I was like, well, I'm going to be the piss head at this club. And I want them to be like, BJ doesn't care about footy. He just cares about having a crack on the piss. And you know, that's why he's not playing seniors, not because he's not good enough, but because he just doesn't care enough. I fell into that massively.
It's a big thing, isn't it, man? Like it's nearly like a lot of people do this. It's like you're nearly giving yourself an out. Like you're pretty much burying yourself before you're even giving yourself a chance. And I think we really do this a lot.
It's so like, you know, if I don't care about something, then I can't be hurt by it. That's 100%. That's totally what I was doing. Yeah. And, you know, and I know a few guys that did it, and to hear, you know, that you recognize that other people do it too, it kind of makes me feel a bit like better in a way, but I wasn't the only one doing it.
Oh yeah. No, I don't think it is, man. And I think there's plenty of people out there that would do this and to be able to reflect on it now. And that's like a big thing. Like I'm going around in circles today. It's nearly like a bloody therapy session for me. But I think that a lot of these things you look back on, you go, fuck, I was such an idiot. But in a way it's made me who I am now. So like, I'm really thankful for it as well.
Well, yeah, you don't list like it's maturing in a way, but you know, like they do tell you at the start of your career, like you probably won't be the guy that plays X amount of games. Like they warn you about that stuff, but the way we're geared and the way we kind of hone ourselves as athletes is to just deny that and reject it. And I don't know, maybe it's sharing that story in a different way, or sharing more of those stories will help people understand it. But yeah, it's just a natural thing, I guess, to do at the time.
Episode 95, Mark Wales. What, I suppose, are some of the stories that you would reflect on now being like some of the most intense tours or missions that you were a part of?
One for me was one of the first missions I did on my first deployment over there. It was, we were asked to clear the Chora Valley, and it was in late 2007. And I talk about this actually in the book because it was the first time we ran into a heavy combat on a mission. And basically we went in there to run this clearance. There was kind of 80 to 100 Taliban, I think they were saying. And our team was doing all the advanced force operations. So we were going behind enemy lines, looking at what the enemy were doing, trying to figure out where they were, so that when the mission came, we were much ahead of the curve already. And on the first morning, we kind of inserted in the dark and got set up. And in the morning, all the clearance force landed and took out and started clearing through the section of the valley that we were in. And me and my team picked up and went to another part of the valley further south to put in basically an ambush. And as we're moving down there, we ran into Taliban kind of defensive positions. And that started a battle that went for a long time. And it took us till, that was in the morning, we didn't get out until that night. So we were in there for a long time. and ended up being a heavy battle. One of my team leaders was shot and killed in the opening kind of minutes of the battle. And I mean, we train for that all the time. We say, if we have a man down, this is what we're going to do. We're going to move him. And so we had to change our whole mission kind of on the fly to try and get this guy out who'd been shot and badly wounded. So it was full on. It was full on.
How, no, look, I suppose I know the answer to this, but how do you deal with that, like, sudden change straight away? Do you go straight into, like, autopilot of training? Is that how, like, you're so much in the moment that you go, fuck, this is what we need to do next?
Yeah, I think that there's almost like a cutout switch in your mind. There's so much happening that you're like, all right, there's a lot happening that I'm just not going to deal with right now. We're just going to do, we're going to do one thing and then we're going to do this thing. And you're looking 5 seconds into the future sometimes. You're just like, I'm just going to survive through this bit. I'm going to jump in this ditch and then I'm going to, you know, speak to this guy. And you're making decisions in tiny increments because you know to survive, you've just got to get to that next step. And then once we were kind of secure, that's when you start thinking about how to move troops around and how you're going to suppress the enemy and how you're going to get helicopters in. And that's, I guess, where you go from just trying to survive to, all right, now we really have to come up with a plan to defeat what we're dealing with.
How did you, are you allowed to go into context of how you did get out of that scenario? Like what ended up transpiring?
So what we did was we all pushed up to this kind of, this low ditch called an aqueduct. It's kind of knee height or waist height and it's just enough cover to get in there and get protection from gunfire. So we were in there, we were pinned down dealing with a casualty and we got, there were two Apache gunships. These are attack helicopters. They're above us. And
on the Australian side or were they from the Taliban?
No, Australian side. Yep. I'd be worried if the Taliban were driving those.
Yeah.
We'd be in real trouble. But, we had attack helicopters above us and some of my guys was talking directly to the helicopters and marking the enemy positions with smoke. And so all this was happening as I was trying to move troops in place. And I remember hearing the first kind of cannon strike go in on the tree line, kind of maybe about 100 meters away. It was pretty close. And the tree line just bloody erupted in all this heavy cannon fire. And I remember seeing going, holy shit, if they're that close, then we're in a bit of trouble. And so the Apaches were trying to suppress the enemy that were on the other side of us. And I kind of remember saying, hey, I think they're going to come around our flank. I remember talking to the guy next to me. I think they're going to come around this flank in the river. And luckily, one of the guys in the team had a good idea about putting a sniper team up on that on basically a little hill, little section of high ground about 1,000 meters away to our left, and they were protecting our flank. They could see people coming up the river while we were in the thick kind of green belt, thick vegetation, and they started shooting in support of us. So we had kind of gunships firing on one flank and snipers firing the other, and I could hear their kind of heavy rounds coming down the valley, and they were landing close to us, like very close. I could kind of see the trees moving as the bullets were coming in from our snipers, and I was thinking they're bloody close because it's hard to see, right? You're trying to stay low. It is hard to see enemy to your front, so you're trained to shoot at areas where you think they might be hiding. So we were basically just trying to get space and to suppress the enemy so we could move a bit. And eventually we did. We were able to kind of suppress them enough that we could move this guy back who'd been hit and bring helicopters in to try and evacuate him. And the helicopters that flew in, this is in broad daylight now, the helicopters that flew in flew over the Taliban formation and they got shot up. You know, they took about, I think it was about 7 rounds. One helicopter took 7 rounds. And they landed and we got this guy on and got him flying back to base. But unfortunately, he'd already died. He was badly wounded. So,
how dangerous is this SAS training? The selection training.
The some of the training is really dangerous because it's done at a super high level, and the idea is it's got to be at a really high level, live rounds, you know, in the dark, night vision, because that's what we're going to face in combat. And so they don't baby you in training. They we do it safely, but sometimes you're exposed to really dangerous situations. You know, Black Hawk accident. I think it was mid-90s, two Black Hawks collided on approach to target, and I think it was about 16 guys were killed.
Own, like, friendly?
Two helicopters, two Black Hawks collided, and a lot of guys were killed in that. I had a mate killed in the South Pacific in a helicopter crash, vehicle accidents. It's dangerous stuff. It's really dangerous training. And before you've even gotten to Commac, you've got to get through all that stuff. And we've got the names on the memorial of a lot of guys that died training. It's risky.
Transitioning out, as we mentioned, you're at Duntroon, instructing the youth coming through that are about to transition to the next phase of their journeys. Something that, you know, is prevalent, I suppose. I'm not sure how common it is, but something that can be highly expected in a role that you've done and face and done such a good job at is post-traumatic stress from these things. And, you know, you've helped so many people with this post your career in the SAS. Was it always something that you were passionate in talking about and helping people, or was it something where you sort of only realised that you could actually help people by sharing your story?
I think it's something that when I first knew I was dealing with it, I guarded it closely because I wanted to keep working in that space. I didn't want some mental health issue taking me out of that operational space. So I had to kind of deal with it myself. I went and spoke to a psychiatrist and a psychologist, and some of them were helpful and some of them weren't. But over years, I had to basically look after myself. I had not been looking after myself, really. And you have to, I think, when you've got this, you've got to accept, all right, I need to understand what's wrong with me. Then I need to make all these small changes to my life so that it doesn't dominate me and I can still work. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the hardest, bits, because you're just not trained to deal with that, really. And it's not something I talked a lot about until I got out of the army and then went back into kind of keynote speaking. And I spoke to some companies about it, and they really latched onto it. And I didn't realize this until recently, but it's actually, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of burnout. There's a lot of mental health issues, even in the workforce, because of how we're structured now and smartphones and working long hours. It's people are burned out.
And what's your messaging to someone that, you know, is suffering or is going through something like this? What helped you the most? Like you said then that you weren't looking after yourself. What were you not looking after yourself with? Was it just day-to-day things or giving yourself time to breathe or, you know, accept your story and accept your journey?
I wasn't doing the basics, right? Like if you stop sleeping, if you drink too much to try and self-medicate, if you're not eating properly, all these things contribute to your overall physical and mental health. And I think I'd really taken a step back in that front. You're meant to be an elite soldier, but I wasn't looking after myself enough. So I went to one guy that was a neuroscientist and a psychologist as well. And he explained the science of it. He goes, your mind, you've completely had to rewire it while you've been in combat. You've been overusing a really ancient part of your mind. And while you've been doing that, trying to survive, the more evolved parts have really taken a back step. They've been benched. So he basically said, we're going to rebalance you. This is how we're going to do it. We're going to concentrate on your diet, exercise. You're going to rest more. You know, you're going to book a surf trip each year with your mates and go out and have some fun. And I think being disciplined about that consistently is hard to do. So people get busy, they stop doing all that. 100%. Stop exercising. You know, it's hard to do it, to have the self-discipline to do that stuff consistently. And that's kind of what I preach. I'm just like, just go back to basics, look after yourself, get some sleep.
Episode 95, Mark Wales.
What do we end up at Rob Pattinson's house saying?
Yeah, please tell me this story. This is unbelievable. I was just watching Josh, Tenet. I was watching Tenet the other night, and yeah, I need to hear this story.
Yeah, someone was we were with Bag Raiders or something.
You said you didn't mean anyone. You just drop Bag Raiders in casually.
They're from Sydney. They're just about the same as us. That's not. they're great.
We're all the next big thing.
Yeah, but one of our friends was like a director, and he was friends with Sean Penn's daughter, Dylan Penn.
It's my name.
Right, there you go.
Are you his daughter?
Maybe.
And she was dating Rob Pattinson. So we'd been there. We got invited to the party. And it was in like Mulholland Drive or something like that. And you had to go through the gated thing and say the password. And the password was his dad's name, Tom Pattinson.
So now you can all get
What's
in.
The password?
Anyone going to Rob's house? Yeah, Tom Pattinson.
Yeah, so we said Tom Pattinson and we went in. And he was super wasted. And every time he would talk to any of us, he'd sound Australian, then he'd sound American, and then he'd sound English.
I understand that, though.
What's that?
Like some people,
pick up what they've got.
Yeah. I reckon I do that.
I guess you're like that as an actor, aren't you?
He was trying to be method. That's what he told me.
He was trying to be method. Yeah. He was like, so tell me, guys.
These guys are
What's it like to be a musician? You know, what's like the greatest song? It's just this weird. I'm like, oh, dude, shut up.
Yeah. Oh, I think I've asked that question today.
Nah, you're fine. But he was just like kind of drunk and swaying around and trying to like, just give it up, mate. But then anyway, so that was that night. But so then a few weeks later, yeah, we were at a Bad Graders DJ set in West Hollywood or something, and it was like, right, another party back at Rob Pattinson's. So we Ubered back there, and I was just
Tom Pattinson. Really, Tom Pattinson.
Like, been snorting heaps of blow. So I was just really like ready to go. And we just got there, Tom Pattinson, yeah, let us through, and just got to the door. Like,
I'm back.
Rob, like just banging, Rob. And no one came to the door, like ringing the doorbell. I was like, oh, fuck, I'll just open it. And so I just opened the door and I'm in his living room just yelling out, Rob. And no one appears.
Poor
so I'm
Rob.
Like, oh, let's just make ourselves at home. Everyone will be here shortly. So we get in the hot tub. We've got a bottle of his tequila doing lines like off the side of the hot tub. And then about an hour goes past. It's 5 a.m. We're like, no one's here. We've just broken and entered into Rob Pattinson's house, basically. Like, shit, we better get out before anyone's find us. So we just go into the fridge, grab a few bottles of champagne and take some of his booze and then just cruised off, and I haven't seen him since.
That is honestly one of the best stories I've ever heard.